It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, MillertonVet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief vet at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. We are happy to have her. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning.
Chloe in Newburgh wonders, how can you tell whether your dog needs a sweater? Before I had a dog, I thought no dogs needed a sweater ever, but I get now that I was being cynical. Still, I'm not sure when it comes to my 2-year-old Aussie Shepherd mix, Maxie. On one hand, even though her fur is medium short without much of a fluffy undercoat, she seems to enjoy colder weather. On the other hand, the other day when we had to stand around for a while without walking, she started to shiver. So, what are the signs of being too cold?
So I'm getting lots of questions, as you can imagine, this past week about cold and dogs. And so I have I've sort of been thinking about this a lot.
Okay.
And I think that a lot of people don't understand that dogs can become hypothermic. So just like people, dogs can become hypothermic. That means that their body temperatures are too low to run their metabolism efficiently. And that's why we shiver. But true hypothermia would be a dangerous situation. So a body temperature that is, for a dog, I would say below 97. They can also get frostbite. So there are lots of things. There's no simple answer to, there is a fairly simple answer to the how do you know when they're cold, and that is mostly the shivering. They usually will look a little bit anxious, too. Shiver and shake and be watching you. Typically, they'll keep looking at you for an answer about what to do because they're so cold. And even an Aussie with all that coat and all that energy and Aussie mix can get pretty cold in the kind of weather that we've had. So the first thing to do is when your dog starts to shiver, then either take them inside, put a coat on, if you can carry a coat or a sweater with you, or start moving, and start moving pretty fast. So that's a good way to warm up. So if you don't have the option of going inside, then you need to get moving again. So dogs can't stand around like we can with our snow pants and our coats on because they will get too cold. They'll start to shiver. They'll start to get anxious, and then go ahead and put that coat on. But you just have to keep in mind that every dog is different as far as their cold tolerance, and it has to do with their age and their body mass, so the size of the dog. The little dogs get colder quicker, their fat stores, their muscle mass, their overall metabolism, and their general health. So if you've got a dog with diabetes or kidney disease or heart disease, circulation's not as good, and they're going to get cold quicker. So if you've got, with this past week, my dogs have lots of coat, and they're usually very warm, but they haven't wanted to stay outside for more than a minute and a half or so.
Yeah, and I need to throw in that the blind spaniel, who created her own avalanche today going the wrong way, was absolutely happy, and I mean insanely happy, to sit out there when everybody else was inside, by the fire with their hot chocolate and the little bubbly marshmallows on top, sipping, and she was outside barking. And but you couldn't get her to come. It wasn't.
Even in the below zero weather?
Insane.
Yes, but you just have to watch that, of course.
Oh, obviously.
The big problem is forgetting that they're out there. You're still opening the door. They go outside if they have invisible fence or whatever, and then some dogs won't ask to come back in.
No. This is frustration.
I understand that you were watching her, but this is what we've had. This is problems that we've had in these past 10 days or so.
Yeah.
It's really something to pay attention to, and an interesting phenomenon that
But it's also a case by case. Is what I'm hearing.
It is, but whenever it's below freezing, you need to most likely shorten your walk, depending on your dog. If you've got a young, really well-muscled, middle to large breed dog, you can go on a longer walk, but you have to be careful about the length of the walk, and their feet get cold,
yeah.
And the feet get crusted with ice balls in between the pads,
yeah.
And then they get lame.
And then they're sitting on the tundra.
or they're lying down. Right. They lie right down to chew the ice balls, and then they get really cold and shivery.
Yeah, we've had all that. Would you say, does it help to, you know how you suit up a kid? Does it help to suit them up first, or is that not?
That's okay to do, especially if you're doing a leash walk. You know, if your dog is loose, they may get too hot, and you can always take that coat off.
Right.
But it's fine to do, and perhaps clip if your dog has long hair between the toes. Clipping the hair will help to reduce the amount of ice balls that build up between the toes.
Is that true?
Because
I've never, and we're talking a long time now, as in never, had any success with ice balls or booties.
Well, the booties are tough, right? If you've got a dog that's running loose, very difficult to have booties that stay on. But if you're going out for a walk, a leash walk, that's a possibility, which some dogs, it's all they can do in that kind of weather, is a very short leash walk. A little dog might need some booties on.
And I will just say that I saw the most adorable, and I still can't get over it, the most adorable matching ensemble in New York on the Upper West Side. It was a cable knit sweater with booties that matched, and the way that the cable just fell over the back. It was really clever.
Mm-hmm.
And
very warm, I'll bet.
Very warm. The dog looked as happy, I mean, not only stylish, but as happy as could be. And it was really interesting because I was miserable. I was like, could someone dress me like that, please?
You have to start knitting.
Right away. All right, Lucas in Great Barrington. My wife and I gave our youngest son a guinea pig for Christmas, now named Jedi. In the hopes of preventing any mishaps, for example, trips to the $1 million emergency vet, we'd like to get our son in the habit of giving Jedi a sort of daily health check. Can you give us an idea of what should be on the checklist?
I think this is a wonderful idea for a guinea pig and for responsibility. So I don't know how old their youngest son is, but any child over the age of 5 or older really should be able to, well, if they can read, go through their checklist. And I think that's a wonderful idea. It can be posted near the cage to make sure that their guinea pig is eating would be number one. So that means that fresh food needs to be put in every day so that you can tell if that food bowl is, if the amount in there is decreasing. Teach your child how to look around for the food. So if your guinea pig has dumped the bowl and the food's underneath, you know, that's a different story. But at least if he sees that the food is not going down, then he's going to let you know. So if you've got a food bowl full of food. Drinking water, I'm not sure that you can tell because guinea pigs don't drink as much, but if he's observing some drinking, would be an interesting thing for him to mark off. Make sure that those little eyes are bright and looking at him, because if they're not, then there could be some lethargy or disease process going on, and make sure that the guinea pig's moving around. So those are four simple things that he can pay attention to, and if that's not happening, come and get you so you can do a better evaluation.
That's a really good idea. In fact, that could be done for any, because it teaches observation as well. And
observation of your pet, absolutely.
Yes. And so,
what is going on? Are they doing all the things that people should do, and that people and animals should do? Eating, drinking, pooping, urinating. It's hard, really hard to tell the pooping and the urinating unless you clean the cage every day with a guinea pig, which most people don't.
All right, and you had said something about water. Do they drink from? Think of the picture of those little bottles, but.
Yeah, but they're not drinking all the time. So if you're, you know, if you've got a child who's going to school and they might not actually observe the water going down significantly in the bottle, and I'm not sure that marking the bottle every day and erasing that is going to be something I thought of.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. So I think the general observation about whether the pig is moving around and head up and eyes bright when you come in, because they do love to be around people. They like to be spoken to and they like to be played with. And if he's not moving around much and not doing the things that he usually does, like wielding his Jedi sword.
I was just thinking of that. We have a little baby guinea pig Jedi lightsaber.
That's a wonderful name.
Yes, it is.
then come and get mom or dad and talk about what might be happening.
Very good. All right, Mike in Albany, are cooked greens safe for dogs to eat?
They are, and wonderful for older dogs.
All right. And is there any such thing as, and this comes out of my ridiculous experience that of thinking that my cat could eat lots of green beans because he loved them, and so he was just chowing down, and that a stop had to be put to that. Is there any such thing as too much? I mean, look, in life, moderation is everything. But
right, because if you're feeding, you know, half of the volume of food is greens, then your dog may not get enough calories, so that would be too much. But a good handful of greens. So number one, the greens are not going to be metabolized well. The cell wall will not be broken down unless the greens are either steamed or cooked or chopped. So some people like to pulverize them in a blender. And the dogs who are older dogs who are what I call in Chinese medicine yin deficient, they do very well on daily greens. I usually have people feed bone broth, make their own bone broth, and add some greens. And what I'll tell them is to, if they want to, do a whole box, one of those large boxes of mixed greens in the blender, steam them a little bit, put them in the blender, add a little bone broth, very little bit of bone broth, and then put that mixture in an ice cube tray. So you've got little ice cubes of greens, and they can be added to the food. So you can melt an ice cube during the day for the night meal and overnight for the morning meal, and just mix it right in with food.
Oh, that's really good. And about how long does that last, by the way?
I mean, if you're using them every day, then one ice cube tray, you mean?
Yeah, I'm just sort of...
Depends on, of course, the size of the dog. So if you have a larger dog, you're going to be using a couple of ice cubes a day. So you really have to... So how many ice cubes are in a tray?
No, it's more just like how long can you safely store it?
Yeah, so I would think that you would be able to for a month. If you made a bunch,
was what I was wondering. Because,
but I don't know for sure. I think that I would, you know, I have greens and lots of things that I make and soup that I make and so forth. I have gobs of greens in there, and they store very well. Usually, don't store things for more than a couple of months. But I would guess that freezing, if you've got a good freezer that keeps things frozen, would keep the nutrients good for a couple of months.
Perfect. All right, Jillian in Pittsfield, this year's batch of Christmas presents included a kitten for my daughter. Within a few days, I contracted ringworm on my arm. Yuck. Please tell me how to prevent this from happening again.
Kittens can carry ringworm. Sometimes they'll have no signs at all. Sometimes, more often, they will have hair missing around the ears and face. So if you see a kitten with hair loss around the face and ears, be very careful even to handle that kitten while you're looking for a new kitten. Some people have to be, it seems, particularly susceptible depending on the strain of fungus. So ringworm is dermatophytosis, and it is caused by a fungus or a dermatophyte. And kittens can carry it, and so your kitten needs to be checked or you will get ringworm again, even if you've been treated. So your kitten needs to be tested for ringworm and then treated. And the treatment is somewhat prolonged, maybe a couple of months. But otherwise, you will get, and you need to treat the environment as well. Otherwise, you may get ringworm right back.
Okie dokie.
So seeing the veterinarian is the thing, because it's too complex to talk about on the phone.
Okay. So you go to the vet. All right.
Yes, absolutely.
Dale in Schenectady. I have two aunts, Aunt Kay and Auntie R. Aunt Kay is renting the guest house behind Auntie R's house and wants to have chickens. Auntie R is a vet tech who has three dogs. She will not allow to have Aunt Kay to have chickens on her property because she says her dogs will catch a disease from Aunt Kay's chickens. I've had chickens and dogs in the past, and it wasn't a problem. Auntie R is a vet tech, though. What's she talking about?
So this question is comes up quite a bit, too, to me. And chickens, of course, have lived with dogs, probably since chickens came around. the biggest problem people have is that the dogs will eat the chickens. But chickens can carry diseases that potentially can transmit to people and diseases that could potentially transmit to dogs. So if they're housed separately, it shouldn't be a big risk if your chickens are healthy and they're cared for well. So that means keeping the coop clean. Things such as there are some fungal diseases that can grow in the chicken poop. So it's in a wet, dark area, which is often the floor of a coop, such as, that actually can be breathed in. So dogs who are eating chicken poop or in the coop, breathing in the spores potentially of things like histoplasmosis, which is more common in the central part of the country than here. Aspergillosis is probably the most worrisome. Aspergillosis is caused by a fungus as well, and dogs can inhale that and get all kinds of lesions up inside their nasal cavities. That fungus can really eat away at the turbinates in the nose and cause chronic problems. Very difficult to get away, to get rid of, even with surgery and so forth. But these are not common things. This is pretty rare, and your dog has to be susceptible and has to be allowed to go in the coop. Salmonella is another possibility. People can get salmonella from chickens, and so can dogs, although dogs are less, my belief is that dogs are less susceptible than people. I think there's a poultry flea that could also get on dogs, but if you're treating your dog for fleas, protection against fleas, then that's going to be fine. So there are a few things, but realistically, if your chickens are housed, you know, separate so that the dog can't get at them, and the coop is kept really clean, then the risk to you and your dogs is really low of transmitting disease.
So Auntie R's Vet Techery probably gives her access to more information, but...
It's true, and those are things that we think about. If you know about it, you think about
right.
it. And if you ever see a dog with aspergillosis who's just constantly at the veterinarian and goes to the specialist to get their sinuses, you know, reamed out because they're full of fungus and they never get better, and you think, oh my gosh, I don't want to have anything to do with that. So it is a legitimate concern for someone who's actually seen a dog sick with one of those diseases. But in reality, the risk is low. And so, you know, I don't want to be the mediator here. But
yeah, nor I. So Dale, have them fight it out.
Right. Coming to a happy, you know, conclusion about housing the chickens. So
yeah.
That's the thing. If you have chickens that are free range with three dogs running around, that somebody's going to get eaten, and it's probably not the dog.
Yeah, and that's what I tend. We have chickens across the street that you know, just one barks at, one wants to be friends with, and I just have you know, some form of PTSD because way back when I had a retriever that thought it was his sworn responsibility to bring back the chickens.
Mm.
I was like, yeah, please don't. Yeah. And the quizzical look that goes with, why not?
I know, and they're people's pets, and they...
I know. It's yeah. just so I always tend more towards that practical complication than the disease-bearing.
Right.
But that's, you know, that's just... That's historic. this is a broader question, but... and we've got a couple minutes left, and I don't... It's a pretty chunky topic, but how often, or there's so much interest in complementary practices, you know, acupuncture and herbals and Chinese medicine and so forth, that I am curious, how do people come into you now and say, hey, this is what I want, at the exclusion of traditional medicine? How is that balancing out?
There are people who want to just go with complementary medicine,
alternative,
natural, more natural anti-drug medicine. And it is, you know, I'm an integrative practice, so it sometimes makes it difficult for me choice-wise. People definitely can do that. We can go that route, but we can't go that route as far as rabies vaccination, because rabies vaccination is protecting my staff. And so, you know, dogs who are healthy legally need to have a rabies vaccine. And so I can't expose my staff to dogs and cats more likely cats who are not vaccinated, or if they're not well, they have to at least be titered. So we need to know that they have a decent antibody level against rabies and that they don't go outdoors. And even then, if they have a titer, at least I feel comfortable that they are not going to infect my staff. But it's not necessarily a legal way to go. So that's one issue. Deworming pets without chemicals is really something that's not efficient.
Right. Same for dogs?
For dogs, yeah. So it just doesn't work. In my hands, it hasn't worked. Can animals live with parasites? Probably. If they're middle-aged, they can. But, you know, I think most people don't like those little worms that crawl out and get on your couch, et cetera.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that what if somebody brings their kid over? It sort of wants a wider, more, it cannot be a laser focus. That's the whole point to me. I've always been interested, and that's why it was at one time before it was alternative. It was called complementary because you used it. It's what you say integrative, and it used to be complementary because it was used as part of. And my personal inclination is always, you know, you take the best of both.
But... Right. And, you know, we have dogs who are there because of the way they've evolved with us. And their immune systems are not always great, even if they're on a good diet. And even if we do everything right, their immune systems aren't great. So are you going to leave a dog who's got a terrible staph infection all over, you know, all over his belly with no oral antibiotics? You know, when antibiotics are needed, they are a godsend, and they are needed. You can do as much bathing as you want. You're going to have terrible dry skin. You know, so all of these things that if we try not to use an antibiotic, number one, it's not necessarily the best thing for the dog. If you have a dog with repeated issues, you don't want to constantly be using antibiotics unless it's absolutely necessary because your dog's 19 and nothing else is going to work. So you have to weigh those things. There is nothing inherently bad about drugs, basically. It depends on the length of time that you use and the type of drug that you use.
Right, and I would think that also for flea and tick prevention, I remember going back to, a big argument I had with a major drug company who insisted that what was in their product was perfectly healthy, and you know that's tricky as well. Have you had any real?
It is. There are people who don't use any flea and tick prevention, and that's a lifestyle choice, absolutely. As long as your dog's not miserable. So you know there are people who live that way, and I do understand that because there are bodies out there whose constitution doesn't allow them to take anything that's not natural. It makes them really ill. And so it's certainly the possibility that it's the same for dogs or that people want that for their dogs and cats. And so it's just a lot more work. And potentially, for instance, you know, trying to get rid of fleas, it's a lifestyle change. So you're not going to want to ever take your dog around other animals and never let them off leash because they may roll in an animal that would pick up fleas. So, you know, it's sort of a lifestyle and life choice issue, and I'm absolutely happy to treat that way if everybody's on board.
Thank you very much, and it's always a pleasure. This has been
Vet
Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.